This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of New Books Intellectual History, part of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Thomas Edward Kingston, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Mark William Palin, who's the Senior Lecturer at the University of Exeter and a Fellow of the Royal Historical Society. Mark William Palin is the author of Pax Economica, Left-Wing Visions of a Free Trade World, out now with Princeton University Press. This book aims to provide the forgotten history of the liberal radicals, socialist internationalists, feminists, and Christians who envision free trade as the necessary prerequisite for anti-imperialism and peace. It's been an absolutely fascinating book, and I'm really, really glad to have you joining me here today. So welcome.
Well, thank you for having me.
So, yeah, I think, first of all, this book is, I found it both surprising, readable, and enjoyable. That's not both, but that's three, but that's still good. How did you come about writing it?
Well, thank you for those kind words. When I was thinking back, because this is 8 years in the making now, but when I first, I think, got the seeds of something here was when I was doing research for the first book, which ostensibly just went up to the 1890s. But I kind of started having a peek in the archives at some of these people and organizations that I was looking at and seeing what they were doing during the First World War. And one of the things I found was that there were these free trade and peace organizations in New York City and Boston that had these, you know, really, really impressive international list of officers. On top of that, within that, there were quite a number of socialist internationalists that I recognized, quite a number of radical women suffragists. And so I had this, I was like, what is this connection between First World War peace activism and free trade? And how is it intersecting with all these other liberal reform movements and even radical left reform movements of the time? And so I put it on the back burner. And then, but once I started kind of pulling on those strings and seeing where those led, it kept taking me in these new directions that ended up being this book.
I mean, and I think that's one of the things that really stands out is there is this sort of continuous thread that leads to the present day, where it might necessarily not make complete sense in terms of what we expect, but it is a very cohesive thread of this sort of intellectual lineage and these ideas. And yeah, it really isn't what you expect. I mean, when we talk about free trade now, we definitely think of it as sort of market liberalism, like neoliberalism, sort of this very like US dominated notion. And when we think of the left, we often think of protectionism, whether that's in terms of an anti-American stance or a sort of protecting like workers from exploitation and the global markets. I mean, and that's like obviously one of the big leftist critiques of organizations such as IMF and World Bank and the European Union. So yeah, that was a real surprise to me, even as someone who likes to find things that are a little bit different. And I mean, it really is something that was quite popular and prevalent. I mean, I was quite surprised to see Marx and Engels popping up. I mean, I know that there is a sort of, some might say, a misunderstanding about their attitudes towards things like capitalism. And I mean, obviously they're not fans, but there is this, like, there's a level of respect / acknowledgement for the progress it brings. So when they're talking about free trade, what sort of role does that play for them?
You touched on a lot of good points there, and I think, well, I guess before I begin on Marx and Engels and free trade, it might be useful to kind of flesh out those points you made at the beginning, which is where the majority of the scholarship has been focused on in recent years, and the majority of the criticisms from the left and increasingly from the right, which is this market liberalism of the kind of post-1990, post-Cold War era, the kind of culmination of what some have called neoliberalism. It's often associated with right-wing free marketeers and intellectuals like Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, right? And some of the often coercive elements that come into play in freeing markets in Cold War and after. One of the things I kept finding, though, as I was going backwards and forwards in time from the First World War, was this was not the story that I was finding. Right? This was not a right-wing intellectual narrative. This did not fit comfortably within this neoliberal scholarship that usually stops in the 1930s. And so, I think one of the ways I kind of come at this anew is by pushing the chronology back quite a bit, as you point out, going back to the days of Karl Marx and Frederick Engels in England, for that matter. And so, I think that's part of what we have to understand. And yes, I think too we have the Cold War, I think, has obfuscated a lot of history as well as what it did for the international order. Maybe come back to that later, but I think maybe also that kind of skews the way that we think of the left and its opposition to free trade and the way that we understand these kind of things and assume that those must have been the same 100 years prior. And I think going back to 1840s Britain, when Engels is setting up shop in Manchester, and Karl Marx joins him soon thereafter, they are in this kind of hotbed of free trade activism that at the time, at least, is more being taken up by those left of center in Britain as an ideology, this middle-class free trade movement, that's seeking to overturn the protectionist system in Britain in the 1840s. And Marx and Engels are living there, and they are sort of being swept up to an extent in this moment. And they give it their socialist seal of approval once Britain embraces free trade with the overturning of the Corn Laws in 1846. And the reason why Karl Marx and Engels do it, it's not because they buy into all of the ideas that these kind of left of center free trade internationalists are putting forward out there. They don't really buy into the connections between free trade and world peace, like a lot of their subsequent socialist disciples will. But they do agree, or at least they see this as an evolutionary step of the capitalist system. So they see this as a shift from this mercantilist protectionist system that had dominated the empires up until this point. And Britain's turn away from that mercantilist protectionist system in 1846, from Marx and Engels, seemed to herald a new epoch in the capitalist evolution, which meant then, in their view, it was the next progressive stage of the capitalist system towards ultimately socialist revolution, right? So that's why Karl Marx gives a speech in the late 1840s when he says, we as socialists are free traders, and we should be, right? This is the next stage. This is speeding up the beginning of the end of the capitalist system. It's also integrating markets and thereby integrating and connecting the laborers of the world, So the workers of the world are uniting to a certain extent through this free trade system. So I think for those two main reasons, you get this early socialist internationalist endorsement from Marx and Engels. So obviously, this is going to be very different from how the socialist internationalists of, say, the early 20th century are going to embrace free trade ideas.
Yeah. I mean, it makes a lot of sense, in especially in that era. And I think, like, another of the key thinkers that also comes out at this sort of early time is Richard Cobden, obviously probably best known, if people do know him, for his role in anti-corn law things. I mean, personally, I knew him actually in a slightly different way, because he, in relation to my field, he writes the book How Wars Are Got Up in India, against the Second Anglo-Burmese War. And when I was reading the book, I realized that obviously this is the same person, but these two views, this anti-war, this anti sort of expansionist imperialist thing, and the pro-free trade, are actually two sides of the same coin. This is not somebody expressing disparate points of view. This is a continuous thread. And I mean, he plays a pretty big role in the early stages of this left-wing free trade in the UK, right?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And in many ways, he's sort of one of the ideas. So there's this connection that he draws, as you just pointed out too, between free trade ideas, peace activism, and anti-imperialism. And he kind of lived those out when he was a politician, and he lived those out as a grassroots activist when he became one of the leaders of the international peace movement in the 19th century. Somewhat involved with the transatlantic anti-slavery movement as well, and there were some close connections with that too. So when he, first he comes into, I guess, political, influence when he's the leader of the Anti-Corn Law League. But they are successful, the first really successful middle class pressure group to seek out change like this. But the question is, why did he do it, and why were they successful? And I think this gets onto a lot of things. How is it that they were able to shift the British away from this so much? And it was connected to these left of center ideas that he thought free trade. So nowadays we call this interdependence theory, or a capitalist peace theory, the idea that the more markets become interdependent and relying on one another, the less likely you are to go to war with one another. But that's, that's not necessarily going to get a lot of people worked up in Britain at this time. What was getting people worked up even more was the promise of cheap food, right? So the argument was, you've got mass industrialization, you've got mass urbanization, you have lots of poverty, you have people unable to put food on the table throughout Britain by the mid-19th century. And here they come along and they say, well, let's get rid of these really high protective tariffs on foreign grain, so that everybody can afford a loaf of bread and nobody will go hungry anymore. So I think there's that element. But connected to that too was the idea that who gained from protectionist policies like this? And that was the aristocratic landed elites, who owned all the land, monopolized all the land, and who were making excess amounts of money through these protective tariffs by forcing their constituents to buy this more expensive grain from them rather than from their competitors outside. And what does this mean, though, for the international system? Well, if you can undermine the influence of the aristocratic landed elites, who have a lot of say over foreign policy making, and they tend to be very militant and pro-empire, then you can democratize the political system. You can democratize foreign policy. And then you can have a chance to actually have a more peaceful, non-interventionist foreign policy. So for Cobden, this one idea of free trade had implications for the domestic sphere through prosperity, through cheap food, and then for the international sphere through all those points I was just saying about. And then, of course, he lives it out in his vocal opposition to British imperial policies. So there are definitely some in British Parliament by this point, once they turn to free trade, who start trying to enforce free trade coercively. But one of the things I try to emphasize, I think a lot of those guys get more of the attention in historical scholarship. One of the things I try to show is is focusing in on those free traders who were left of center in Britain, who adamantly opposed those coercive attempts at enforcing free trade in India, or financial ties to the Crimean War, or opposing the Opium Wars in China. Another example of this coercive enforcement of free trade that these disciples of Richard Cobden and Cobden himself opposed vehemently. So this is why you have this ideology that he kind of creates or becomes associated with him. It's called Cobdenism in some cases. It's often used interchangeably with the Manchester School, because Manchester, England, was where the kind of center of all this kind of free trade activism was at this point, or Manchester liberalism, and really just building off of Ricardo and Adam Smith and taking it to a whole new level, but really linking it explicitly with issues like anti-slavery and, of course, anti-war and anti-imperial activism.
Yeah, I mean, and ultimately, I think that's something that also comes through is that without being like hagiographic, I think there's a lot of these figures depicted are very, very principled in their approaches. I mean, as you say, there's a certain level of self-interest, and I suppose that's all what we maybe associate it with now, right? Is like a lot of people would go, oh, free trade, but for who? It's for big businesses. Like, is the local bakery going to be able to really benefit from access to like wider markets? And you know, I think that's something that, without getting too political, we also saw surprise people about things like Brexit, right? Is we saw a lot of these smaller traders being like, well, I didn't realize there were going to be all these barriers, and that's such a big problem for me. I mean, you know, to go back to the issue of principles, I think, Cobden loses his seat after the Second Opium War and his opposition to Crimea. And he even ends up having a bit of a sort of moral dilemma about the American Civil War, because he doesn't want war, but he supports the principles. And I think that that's something that really does shine through in the book, is that, and I really enjoyed it, is you really bring out the range of different values that are, shall we say, fueling this enthusiasm or support for free trade, whatever form it takes, because you say it does change. And one person that stood out to me was Jane Addams. So we're fast forwarding a little bit now. But it was once again, somebody I'd never really come across. And I was hoping you could just tell us a little bit more.
Yeah, I mean, she's one that we've come across. I certainly did growing up as social reformer from Chicago, Whole House, and that was about it. And then slowly I came across the fact that, learning more about the international peace movement, women's peace movement, and how central Jane Addams was, especially from the First World War until the early 1930s, she essentially becomes the figurehead of what becomes the women's peace movement. And this is sort of building a lot of, so this is what I try to take everything back to the mid-19th century and then bring it forward. And so for this chapter on free trade feminism that Jane Addams plays a particularly big role in, we first go back to the 1840s and 1850s when you start having the early stirrings of what becomes known as first wave feminism. And its close connections with radical abolitionism in the transatlantic context. So, of course, within that too, you also have women's involvement with the free trade movement in Britain, and as well as in the United States and elsewhere, starting to happen there too. And of course, then we get some socialist feminist involvement, like Florence Kelly in the late 19th century. But it's really then you get the Spanish American War in 1898, when the United States goes to war with the Spanish and wins, and as a result acquires a colonial empire, Philippines, Puerto Rico, informally Cuba, amongst other places. And this is where I think Jane Addams, the social reformer, is becoming more and more of a critic of international conflict already. She's becomes involved with the anti-imperialist movement in 1898, some early stirrings there. As do a handful of other women who are connected to the women's suffrage movement. So you start to see this continued confluence between women's suffragism, the continuities with anti-slavery activism, as a lot of these women will also become involved with the foundation of the NAACP in the early 1900s. And then First World War breaks out, and Jane Addams is among many women who are looking at this war and are saying, this is because women don't have a voice in politics. This war would never have happened if women had a greater share of insight and contributions to foreign policy. Back then, the idea too was women were often seen as the peacemakers, as well as the ones holding the purse strings at home. And so there's, again, that connection between peace and democratization and anti-war activism that's all kind of coming together here. But one of the things that I want to show, and there's lots of great work that's been done on the international women's peace movement. Well, one thing that I kept noticing was largely absent from these discussions was their economic positions. What did they envision? And it didn't surprise me once I started seeing those lists of officers that I mentioned of those free trade and peace organizations during the First World War. Again, this is that who's who, including Jane Addams, showing up on these free trade organizations that were dedicated to peace. But it got me thinking, so did this manifest itself in women's peace activism too? And so I started going through all of the conferences and committee reports and newspapers and radio programs and so forth, these women's peace archives. And I was able to piece together what was a very clear stance in favor of free trade and against protectionism. And again, this goes back to this mid-19th century confluence that Cobden and his disciples were already drawing here, which is, again, free trade creates interdependence and cheap food. And the cheap food part becomes a big part here too with the women's peace movement, which I can come back to. But the alternative there is protectionism creates geopolitical conflict. Think trade wars. Think Trump with the trade wars with China and Canada and the EU after the steel tariffs came into play. Even as we speak, those are still in play. But the way that they connected these things, the protectionism with trade wars leading to geopolitical conflict and the search for markets to find new raw materials to bring back home for the colonies. Tied closely to colonialism from the late 19th century onwards too, as one rival empire after another turns to protectionism to counteract British free trade imperialism. So these are the elements that are all working their way in the women's peace movement. They're very aware of these international relationships. In fact, some of them, like Jane Addams and like Emily Balch, are at the forefront of putting forward these international relations theories for a more peaceful, interdependent world through free trade. And for these women, the biggest losers of war are those who have the littlest control over the wars themselves, women and children. Women and children are the ones that suffer the most, according to this line of thought. And often that comes through starvation, lack of food. So at times of war, like the First World War, it's the blockades that are the kind of the ultimate a protectionist act that ends up adversely affecting women and children through their lack of access to food. But once Jane Addams becomes the head of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom in 1919, one of the first things that they do is they start sending humanitarian missions to Eastern Europe. And Jane Addams goes there. And one of the things she notices is that even though the war is over, women and children are still starving in the hundreds of thousands across Europe in the early 1920s. And her diagnosis is, why is this? Because these newly formed Eastern European states were copying the worst parts of the imperial powers that were rivaling Britain at the time. They were turning to protectionism. So they weren't trading with one another, which meant that they had food aplenty that they could have been trading with one another, but they weren't through these protectionist acts. And so she takes to task this hyper-nationalism and this protectionism of the 1920s as this continuing war against women and children who are continuing to starve. And so what I found going through the Women's Peace Internationalist archives is that free trade remains a clear and strong plank of feminist internationalist peace activism from the mid-19th century all the way up to the, well, after 1945. I trace it as far as I can up and through the Cold War when the archives come to an end. And Jane Addams is the leader for a long time, but it becomes a much bigger cast of characters when, say, with the YWCA joins in on the free trade movement in the early 1930s, and aligns itself with FDR's Secretary of State, Cordell Hull, who maybe we'll come back to, you know, his nickname, among others, being the Tennessee Cobden, right? So there's some confluences there, too, with this reformation of the mid-20th century that what I try to show is the feminist internationalists are intimately involved with, of trying to change the world system from this protectionist world system of the late 1930s, 20th centuries into something much more interdependent, much freer in the wake of the Second World War.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was you set me up very nicely there. You were talking about the Second World War, and of course, the Second World War, and of course, that marks a huge change in terms of geopolitical sort of camps. But the First World War is obviously quite relevant too. I mean, we see it marks the end formally of the German Customs Union, which had been promoted by a certain person called Friedrich List. And he's one of these characters that if the book was a pantomime, people would be booing and hissing as he comes on stage, because he plays this protectionist role. And of course you don't characterize him in such a sort of judgmental way, but his form of protectionism is almost it's obviously drawing from Hamilton, and it's in that sort of vein, it's these sort of ideas that have seen a comeback in people who've tried to look for like intellectual origins of sort of the Trump movement and that sort of these sort of notions. And what I found really interesting about that was he and a lot of people like him, and as we've already said, are sort of pushing protectionism as a pro-imperialism, like a pro-empire thing. Not necessarily colonialism, but a pro-empire thing, or like a nationalist thing. And it starts to get some quite unlikely supporters that you maybe wouldn't necessarily associate with these champions of European superpowers. We start to see organizations like Sinn Féin and the Swadeshi movement supporting protectionism. And I suppose that is kind of the germ of what would grow into what we might understand as modern opposition to free trade from the left. So how did these groups, and why were these groups so anti-free trade?
Good question. If we go back, I think maybe worth prefacing all this is one of the kind of other elements that I've been trying to push back, not just with this book, but with the first book too, is to correct the common laissez-faire free trade portrayal of the late 19th, early 20th century and the decades leading up to the First World War, and to emphasize that it, among all the empires, it's really only the British who stick to free trade from around 1870 onwards, and all of the other empires, one after the other across the late 19th century, effectively turn to protectionism along ideological lines that Friedrich List laid out so famously in 1841 with his book, The National System of Political Economy. And he wrote that in many ways as a kind of counter narrative to what he saw happening in Britain at that point. So he's really, he sees what's happening. It's about to, this free trade movement in Britain. And he doesn't think it's the right time because, the British are going to say that the rest of the industrializing world should follow its lead and embrace free trade. And List is trying to say, no, this is not right. We need protectionism. We need economic nationalism. We need high tariff walls. We need to subsidize industries and build railways using government funds. And this is what states need to do. They need the nation state is the pinnacle, not international trade, right? This, we need to look out for the nation state. And he also, though, said that one of the requirements that would be needed in order for the nation state, like Germany, like the United States, to succeed and succeed in counteracting the more industrially advanced Brit is to embark on colonial adventures. So he's very explicit in the national system. So here we have this free trade, anti-imperialist movement that Cobden's laying out. And at the same time, you've got this protectionist movement that's explicitly endorsing colonialism for some. He's very clear that it's only for these select Euro-American empires that are suitable. And the rest of the underdeveloped world or undeveloped world was to be the area that was supposed to be colonized and exploited for raw materials, seemingly in perpetuity. So his laying something out there is quite imperial. But that said, it is to thwart British free trade imperialism. So in that sense, it's also got that anti-imperial element to it. And it's that anti-imperial element that anti-colonial nationalists within the British imperial sphere are going to latch on to. And kind of, you know, there's a lot of selective reading going on. We do this, I'm sure we still do a lot of selective reading now. And the case was the same for the late 19th, early 20th centuries, these narrow readings of these texts and finding what they wanted. And Frederick List becomes sort of the secular Bible of these anti-colonial nationalists in the British system. So there's been some great work that I was able to draw on that has done this with the Swadeshi movement. And so I was able to build on that. The Swadeshi movement, which started in 1905, at least with the partitioning of Bengal, which becomes this grassroots anti-British boycotting movement and buying Indian Swadeshi-made products. You know, these kind of grassroots methods that places like India had to resort to because British free trade, coercive British free trade imperialism didn't allow for them to have their own tariff autonomy. So Ireland, India, China, Egypt a bit later, they don't have tariff autonomy. So they resort to these grassroots methods of boycotts and buying domestically made products and occasionally burning British goods in nice fashion in market squares. And so this is why you have these exceptions in the late 19th, early 20th century. But I make the point in here, though, that these are exceptions to the rule because, again, Britain is the only empire enforcing these coercive free trade policies in some of its colonies that I just named. So then you have Arthur Griffith and launching of Sinn Féin also in 1905. I think it's actually a bit more than coincidental, at least that's what I try to suggest in the book, the confluences between the Sinn Féin movement as an anti-colonial economic nationalist movement and the Swadeshi movement, I think was a really interesting one there. When Arthur Griffith launches the Sinn Féin movement, he gives this speech in 1905 in which he explicitly says he's a disciple of Frederick List's national system for all those kind of anti-colonial reasons. And you've got Indian anti-colonial nationalists like Benoy Kumar Sarkar, who undertakes the first Bengali translation of Frederick List's national system after his travels to Germany and the United States and Japan around the First World War. And so you have this direct links and similar connections I try to show with some Chinese nationalists in the early 20th century as well. So again, these areas that are having free trade forced upon them by the British, those are the areas where you find these moments, these anti-colonial nationalists embracing economic nationalism during this earlier period. You know, one of the things I also try to show, though, is that majority of the empires, the U.S. Empire, the German Empire, the Japanese Empire, the Russian Empire, they did something different. They implemented protectionist policies onto their own colonies. And so one of the things I show is that there's also quite a few anti-colonial nationalists who are free traders. In the case of the Philippines and Puerto Rico and Cuba, as well, I show it within the American Empire context. So, and when the U.S. Empire is enforcing these coercive protectionist policies, not allowing for free trade between Puerto Rico, say, and the United States mainland, and immigration, restrictive immigration policies against its colonies. These protectionist policies are exactly what the nationalists are pushing back against in those contexts. And so, again, the exceptions to the rule end up being the Irish and the Indians and the Chinese nationalists from this kind of more global perspective.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a really another thing that does shine through. I mean, I suppose one would expect it given the notion of free trade being so international, but the sort of reach of it. I mean, you mentioned that Sun Yat-sen is inspired by George's theory. I mean, to today, and the Republic of China still has land value tax to a certain extent. And this is something that, like, I've come across in my own research as well. Sort of acceptance of certain what might be seen progressive Western ideas in order to further a nationalist sort of cause. I mean, you have some Chinese thinkers who are deemed socialist at a time who later become very conservative because they're basically saying we need the means of production because that we like taking over land, and there's been all these sorts of debates about that. I mean, I think one of the, I suppose it always will be, but given the links between sort of free trade, or the links this book puts forward about free trade and peace and the left, one of the real sort of seismic moments, or the first of a number of seismic moments, I suppose, is the First World War. As you mentioned, the after effects, of course, I suppose, and then obviously we have the League of Nations coming about. And then we enter this sort of quite protectionist phase. I mean, you've already mentioned that most empires and most nations were using protectionist models, but even the UK switches to that right after the First World War. And also the First World War marks the United States' real entry as a world power, right? And so what are these interwar years like, especially with regards to things like the Smoot-Hawley tariffs and role of people like Cordell Hull?
We have an economic nationalist and an imperial system by and large in the years leading up to the First World War, but you're absolutely right that the First World War itself brings trade, international trade, to a screeching halt, effectively. And the free trade and peace, these left-wing globalists that I'm looking at, they were hoping that the lessons would have been learned, right? And that clearly this economic nationalism and imperialism didn't work, and it culminated in the First World War, where we should do something different. We should do something international. We should do something about independence, freer trade, cheap food, and so forth. But this is not what happens, right? So the League of Nations is rather toothless in order to enforce any sort of kind of freer trade regime. And so this return to beggar-than-neighbor politics picks up in a just even bigger way, the trade wars in an even bigger way, especially once the United States passes the Smoot-Hawley tariff just a handful of months or so after the Great Depression struck. That just world trade seizes even further. Trade wars break out between former trade allies, worsening geopolitical conflict. And this is, again, the left-wing globalists of the time are looking at all this rather helplessly and saying, this is exactly what we're saying you should not be doing, or you're going to just lead to another world war, right? So in many ways, I'm sure they would prefer not to have been vindicated from this perspective, but as far as they see it, the Second World War seems rather inevitable if things continue the way they were going, right? So that was how they were seeing the protectionist developments of the interwar years. And this is where you start to see a lot more activism. So you see with the First World War, this free trade and peace activism picks up in a big way. And so the more economic nationalist the world order becomes in the interwar years, the more active the free trade and peace movement becomes too. And so in the years surrounding the First World War, this is where you start to have a new generation of, say, socialist internationalist thinkers who are way more endorsing of these free trade and peace connections than Karl Marx and Engels were 50, 60 years earlier. And so this, you have Edvard Bernstein and Karl Kautsky, who else? Crystal Eastman, a feminist internationalist in the United States. Florence Kelly's still there. The socialist internationalists that are making their way into the Christian peace movement around this time, the First World War and after, is picking up pace in a big way too. And then of course the women's peace movement under Jane Addams's presidency is also picking up speed in the 1920s and 30s. And so you have a very conservative attempt. I mean, you want to throw in the international cooperative movement, which also began in the 1840s in Britain, as another sort of kind of third way socialist internationalist attempt to create a more peaceful free trade world through this cooperative framework too, that, that a lot of these people are working with. And to the point that you have a really massive hundreds of thousands of people involved in this free trade and peace campaigning. And this is going to culminate with, so yeah, that, as you pointed out, the British themselves will succumb to this protectionist trend of the 1920s and 30s. So in 1932, Britain itself, long this kind of lone bastion of free trade, succumbs to this imperial trade preference of the empire and abandons free trade once and for all in 32. And in many ways, combined with the Smoot-Hawley tariff of 1930 in the United States, this compounding of things in the early 1930s, throw in the Japanese invasion of Manchuria and then Italian invasion of Ethiopia in 35, right? You've got imperialism, you've got trade wars, you've got, and at this point, you have no power advocating for free trade internationalism. And then enters Cornell Hull stage left, right? And so he comes in as FDR. So FDR gets elected and takes over in 33. And this is really the first time that you have a Secretary of State who Cornell Hull gets appointed that kind of fully embraces these left-wing globalist understandings, these Cobbleite ideas of connecting free trade, peace, non-interventionism, prosperity. And he becomes the new spokesperson for the free trade and peace movement. And it's under Cordell Hull's Secretary of State reigns of 33 to 44, that you see the overturning of the American protectionist system finally. The trade liberalization projects of Cordell Hull set the stage for the global trade liberalization that's going to follow at least for a bit after the Second World War ends, through these new supranational institutions that will, the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade in 47 that becomes the WTO in the mid-90s, amongst other of these groups, organizations that Cordell Hull is setting the stage for. His other nickname, other than Tennessee Cobden, is Father of the United Nations, right? So it's about supranational governance and maintenance of a more interdependent world that he helps usher in. But one of the things I try to show in each of the chapters, though, is that each of the groups, the liberal radicals, the socialist internationalists, the feminist free traders, and the Christian peace movement, each in their own way, start getting behind Cordell Hull's trade and liberalization reforms. They start getting behind his good neighbor policy, a non-interventionist policy towards Latin America, because they see eye to eye. In fact, the best, one of the greatest things that I can't take credit for it. I have to give all the credits to the archivist at the Sophie Smith archives, as this feminist archives in Smith College. I'd given a talk towards the end of my fellowship there a long time ago, and kind of what I'd found so far about this free trade activism amongst the feminist internationalists. And one of the archivists pulled me aside and said, "You need to look at the Young Women's Christian Association papers." And I said, "Okay." And she wheeled out just these boxes of books, boxes of archival materials, just with a layer of dust, clearly other than the archives. I felt like maybe I was the first one to open them up. And probably because the title of them was, I think it was Tariff Reform. I'm sure it wasn't the most exciting boxes on the list of things to look at, but it ended up being just amazing. And I was able to trace how the YWCA, that what you know today would probably claim to be the biggest women's empowerment organization in the world. First, it turns to an out-and-out peace organization in the mid-1920s. But I was able to actually figure out exactly when the YWCA joins this free trade and peace movement in the early 1930s. And so then the YWCA, once they become they agree after seeing all what's happening in the early 1930s that yes, free trade is going to lead to peace and protectionism, the opposite. They start mailing all these businessmen in the United States to try to get them to start donating money to the peace campaign because free trade is good for business is the kind of the argument they're going on. And I found this one letter from a vice president from Ford Motor Company. And he said, I just got your thing. And you know what, though? I need to put you in touch with a friend of mine who sees exactly the same way that how the world should work, free trade and peace and prosperity. And that's Secretary of State Cordell Hull. And so because of this vice president from Ford Motor Company, the YWCA and more broadly the Women's International Peace Movement is put in direct touch with Cordell Hull. And as a result of that, they continue to work together for years and years to come to free U.S. and world trade because of these left-wing beliefs they have.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm really glad you shared that. I mean, I think there's maybe a lot of you appreciate by a very narrow section, but hopefully you appreciate by more. But there is a certain magic to those moments in the archives that people like to characterize it as just dust and solitary work, which it definitely is at times. But there are those moments where you find something is just like, wow, okay, how come nobody's ever thought about this or looked at this or considered this? So yeah, I really do appreciate that. So
and credit to the archivists too.
Yeah, absolutely. The unsung heroes of so many people's books and PhDs.
absolutely.
So yeah, just as we mentioned that there are that the First World War was a pivotal moment, and then we see the Second World War being another sort of pivotal moment in terms of there is this more widespread appreciation for the power of commercial ties in maintaining this level of international cooperation and peace. That's also where it starts to become free trade as we know it, right? As in terms of political alignment with the Cold War coming on. So how does this transition from what has long been a left-wing thing, it's one of the key points that the Labour Party and the Conservatives are arguing over at the start of the 20th century, to where free trade and peace is possibly best exemplified by the so-called Golden Arches theory, where you're placing McDonald's at the heart of peace rather than free trade?
Yeah, and this was perhaps the trickiest, in part because the archive is just, you know, they only go up so far, and partly because I think there's so much good work that's just being done right now as we speak on the post 1945 period, and really getting us to rethink these Cold War often misunderstandings of how the world order looked and who represented what. There's a great deal of optimism in the wake of the Second World War with the creation of the United Nations, and of course the women are more represented in the United Nations than they were in the League of Nations. So the free trade feminists are feeling like they have a much greater say in how the supranational governance is going to run. You've got the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade in 1947 that leads to a drastic slashing of tariff rates, and the United States sort of leads the way. And increasingly, you have, at least at the presidential level, these increasing rhetorical and philosophical associations of free trade and U.S. capitalism, right? So it's something very different from the protectionist American empire of the late 1930s, 20th century. But this doesn't last very long. So, because you get the Cold War, sets in, and any sense of a truly global interdependent system just comes screeching to a halt by 1950. And, you know, both sides are to blame for this, you know, and so I try to show how you know, the United States and the Soviets contribute to this, this multilateralism deficit, if you will. And of course, there's lots of great work that's been done recently on showing how the United States quickly shifts to this Cold War, you know, militant, you know, big military spending, unilateralism instead of multilateralism, instead of trade as its main function or arbiter of international power, military prowess becomes much more the way that the United States increasingly goes from a foreign policy stance. And so you can, this is part of it. So already you start to see the free trade and peace movement, who, you know, at least for a time, seemed to have a decent amount of say on how things were developing. They're once again on the outside looking in. And with their exit from the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and these supranational governing organizations, other people are going to fill in where they left. So you're going to have the increasing, you know, influence of U.S. multinational corporations, who, you know, a lot of great studies more recently, you know, are able to show that these multinational corporations, they didn't care all that much about labor protections or environmental protections. It was mainly about profits. So free trade, yes, but for profits and for protecting private property, in particular theirs, right? So, you know, calling in the troops to go protect these multinational corporations' investments in Latin America, for instance, because some left-wing nationalist movement has tried to nationalize these multinational corporations' investments there. And so protecting property and protecting profits becomes the increasing kind of driver of U.S. Trade policy, and also helps explain why it becomes increasingly interventionist to protect the free, so-called free market system of the Cold War. And then this is going to give way to these what some call neoliberals, right? The Friedrich Hayeks, these intellectuals who are drawing on these more right-wing ideas of free trade and free markets. Yes, they do have the same kind of intellectual wellspring of the Manchester School, but end up going in very different directions, very interventionist directions, very, you know, where the left-wing globalists were very much seeing free trade and democratization as going hand in hand. These new free traders, more and more on the right, are skeptical of democracy and even oppositional to it in the name of freeing markets. And so this anti-democratic, interventionist free market ideology that continues to kind of get more and more influential on policymaking, especially in the United States and Britain from the 1970s and especially the 1980s with the Reagan-Thatcher era, where these ideas kind of enmesh with policy in such a big way. And then, of course, once the Cold War ends, new ideas for a truly global economic, interdependent economic system come into being, but no longer is it the left-wing globalists who have their finger on the pulse. It's these right-wing free marketeers who are the ones kind of pulling the strings and directing things. And so I think this is how we can explain, to a certain extent, the rise of this more free market right-wing association that we, I think, tend to associate with today. And as a result, we've largely forgotten about this left-wing globalist tradition that was, in many ways, instrumental in creating the system that this neoliberal movement is able to make use of. So in that sense, you know, however unwittingly they helped help create this, but at the same time, they were by no means allies with one another. They, again, just like Cobden was critical of the British free trade imperialists of the mid-19th century, these left-wing globalists are critical of this coercive implementation and use of military force and interventionism throughout this period, and you know, do what they can to get around that. So they become much more sympathetic to anti-colonial nationalists in the Cold War era in ways that their predecessors hadn't been, and even sympathetic for the short-term protectionism that these newly decolonized states we're advocating for in part.
Yeah, I mean, when I was thinking about this transition, and I was definitely thinking of the way that Quinn Slobodian phrases it when he's like making markets safe from democracy. And there's actually a great line that I think links in very well with what you've just said from your book, where you do say the economic peace movement of the left may have unintentionally helped pave the way for neoliberalism's right wing ascendancy, but they should not be they should not be conflated with one another. And I think that's something that this book really does make clear. And I think that this like kind of shift from, I suppose you could say, free trade to fair trade, where a sort of ethical approaches. It's possibly another book in that right about this, about the sort of about this sort of commodification of ethics, right? How we've seen that sort of be co-opted as well, and all the sort of obfuscation around supply chains and that sort of thing. I think one of the really great things about this book is it's obviously very clearly a history book, but it still has this really great ability to construct this thread, or threads even. We might compare possibly even a rope, because it's multiple threads woven together that lead us to the present day. If you think about like the Smoot-Hawley thing, we have then Vice President Al Gore giving a signed photo of them shaking hands to Ross Perot when NAFTA was signed in 1993. And obviously one of Trump's big policy sort of points was to get rid of NAFTA, which is this sort of final ascendancy of, I suppose, right-wing ideologues capturing both protectionism and free trade. I suppose that's probably a question for the political scientists, is where do the left come in now, and what space do they create?
I can only do a little bit of that sort of speculation just based off of what I think my left-wing globalist might say, because there's not all, the Christian free trade, left-wing Christian free trade movement largely gets co-opted by the kind of the rightward drift of Christian nationalism during the Cold War. Kind of Cold War hardened a lot, and so that one seems to have largely disappeared. The feminist internationalist peace movement in the early 21st century, you can still find elements of it. So Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Code Pink, quite a few others have been. You can still find these elements of their free trade activism in their critiques of, say, the Cuban embargo. The Cuban embargo becomes sort of the emblematic of not just the Cold War, but the post-Cold War era, the continuance of protectionism as a means of punishing and coercing a weaker state. So the continuance of the embargo against Cuba has become a big one here too for some, that what remains of this free trade and peace organization. So, and you know, there's some sort of center-ish organizations like the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, who they've remained in touch with, and who I think still stick to these kinds of interdependence ideas. But in the World Trade Organization, as in its current iteration, has these kind of elements in it too. It's a fascinating time. I think they would, these free trade and peace left wingers that I look at would probably be looking on the African trade union that's recently come into existence as a sort of fascinating. Is even as NAFTA is being shredded and by Trump, you had this African trade union happening, and that I thought was such a fascinating sort of juxtaposition of as the United States and Britain seem to be abdicating their their free trade or neoliberal leadership from 2016 onwards. You're starting to see it pop up elsewhere, and so there was those elements to it. But yeah, I Trump in 2016, harking back. I mean, even during his presidency, I was quick to point out he was quoting Republican protectionists from the late 1930s. He was quoting, or whoever was writing his speeches was quoting, Teddy Roosevelt, protection and reciprocity going hand, the handmade, that reciprocity is the handmade of protectionism. This was a speech that Teddy Roosevelt gave when he was president, when he was trying to say why they needed to enforce this protectionist reciprocity treaty on the Puerto Rico in order to bind bind them to us, and Cuba to a certain extent too. So the way that we've seen a resurgence, a return to these late 19th, early 20th century protectionist ideas, and even the trade wars, and strangely, maybe unusual to history, we've got both, you know, candidates from the major parties in the United States running on explicitly protectionist platforms, industrial policies, and so forth. And you know, Biden has continued the tariff war with China, and so I think the political scientists will be able to make better predictions, or maybe not. But I think we can definitely say that we are seeing the creation of a new economic order, and we have been for at least the past eight or so years. I think it's been pretty noticeable that something we've been seeing. You know, Gary Gerstle's book, "The Rise and Fall of the Neoliberal Order," right, which suggests this too, that it's on its way out. And I think that. That American politics is certainly demonstrating this, as in sort of right-wing nationalist uptick across the globe that's embracing these ideas. So I think these free trade and peace actors, if they were as they were back then, active now, I think they would be all too familiar with what they're seeing. I think that their solution, though, and I think this is maybe to end on a bit of a high, a bit more optimism. For those who actually find themselves sympathizing, and of course, after doing this book for 8 years, it's tough for me not to have sympathized with my protagonists a bit, and the peace actors a bit, right? But for those who do follow and are looking for that internationalist foreign policy for the 21st century, you know, maybe there is something here, and also something to be said about how this earlier dedication that I show to this left-wing globalist philosophy and ideology and activism created a coalition that crossed the center left to the far left in a way that we don't see right now. Like the left is fractured, let alone uncertain about where it should stand. Are we against neoliberalism? Wait, neoliberalism is on its way out. So what? It's kind of an existential crisis at the same time that there's a fracturing of the left. And so I think maybe one of the potential uses of this earlier story, though, is to show how a coalition was able to be formed and to an extent was able to accomplish its goals, even though it took a very long time. And even if it didn't quite get what it wanted for a variety of other reasons in the decades that followed, that there are some historical lessons that we can draw, I think, for 2024.
Yeah, I mean, I was sort of thinking, as I was getting towards the end, I was thinking a book I'd read last year mentioned that, for example, Niger makes more money from exporting onions than it does uranium, despite being one of France's largest suppliers of uranium. So when we do think about these like dynamics of trade, and this has been some of the rhetoric in some of these coups that have happened in West Africa, is they're trying to redress this imbalance. In terms of preferential agreements, but these are not necessarily organizations that people might initially even frame as having a solid ideological platform, often in the military coups, never mind being pro-free trade. So yeah, we do live in a quite a topsy-turvy world. But I think it was a really enjoyable book to read. I read it in one sitting. And then read it again, actually, just to go back and be like, wait a second, did I read that right? So, but it's something I've recommended to friends as well, because I think it's really just it's a non-yawn-inducing economic history and intellectual history and political history all in one. And I think it's a remarkable accomplishment also to bring something that at initial sort of pitch, just like elevator pitch, might have sounded quite peculiar, I think, and because it just isn't what people expect. I mean, if that took you 8 years, very well spent 8 years, I must say, but dare I ask, what's next?
well, first of all, that's too kind, and I think not sleep inducing. I'll take that. I will take that. That's very kind of you to say. And what's next? You know, I have to say I've got lots of potential things in motion at this point. But one thing that I have been tossing around, and it's because I was asked to write a kind of speculative article for Diplomatic History a few years back, based around the pandemic. And so it ended up getting me to dig in a bit more to the scholarship, or I should say the relative lack of scholarship surrounding the so-called Spanish flu during the First World War and after, and its potential contribution to this economic turn inward that we were just talking about, the 1920s and 1930s were so famous for. Having just lived through a pandemic in which global supply chains came screeching to a halt, and food prices skyrocketed, essentially combined with the other kind of political transitions that we've talked about that's happening since 2016, the pandemic sort of ratcheted all of those things up, and self-sufficiency became the new siren call of vaccine nationalism and things, these kinds of things. I am considering about whether or not there could be something interesting done here about the connection between pandemics and the reshaping of regional and global economic systems in the modern era.
That really does sound fascinating. And I'll hopefully not have to wait 8 years, but I look forward to reading it and hopefully having you as a guest in the future. So thank you very much for joining me. And it's just a reminder that you've been listening to New Books Network. This is an episode on the New Books and Intellectual History channel. And I'm your host, Thomas Edward Kingston. And today I've been delighted to be joined by Mark William Palin, who's a senior lecturer, and to talk about his new book, Pax Economica, out now from Princeton University Press. Thank you.